fall silent, and beyond the mead hall clearing I'd hear the creak of harness leather. The watchmen and their dogs would stand stock still as if lightning struck. Then the dogs would bark, and the next instant the door would bang open, and men would come tumbling, looking crazy, from the mead hall. The enemy's horses would thunder up into the clearing, leaping the pig fences, sending the cows and the pigs away, mooing and squealing, and the two bands of men would charge. 20 feet apart they would slide to a stop and stand, screaming at each other with raised swords. The leaders on both sides held their javelins high in both hands and shook them, howling their lungs out. Terrible threats from the few words I could catch. Things about their fathers and their fathers' fathers. Things about justice and honor and lawful revenge. Their throats swollen, their eyes rolling like a newborn colt's, sweat running down their shoulders. Then they would fight, spears flying, swords wonking, arrows raining from the windows and doors of the mead hall and the edge of the woods. Horses reared and fell over, screaming. Ravens flew crazy as bats in a fire. Men staggered, gesturing wildly, making speeches, dying or sometimes pretending to be dying, sneaking off. Sometimes the attackers would be driven back. Sometimes they'd win and burn the mead hall down. Sometimes they'd capture the king of the mead hall and make his people give weapons and gold rings and cows. It was confusing and frightening, not in a way I could untangle. I was safe in my tree, and the men who fought were nothing to me, except, of course, that they talked in something akin to my language, which meant that we were incredibly related. I was sickened, if only at the waste of it. All they killed, cows, horses, men, they left to rot or burn. I sacked all I could and tried to store it, but my mother would growl and make faces because of the stink. The fighting went on all that summer, and began again the next, and again the next. Sometimes, when a mead hall burned, the survivors would go to another mead hall, and stretching out their hands would crawl unarmed up the stranger's hill and would beg to be taken in. They would give the strangers whatever weapons or pigs or cattle they'd saved from destruction, and the strangers would give them an outbuilding, the worst of their food, and some straw. The two groups would fight as allies after that, except that now and then they betrayed each other, one shooting the other from behind for some reason, or stealing the other group's gold some midnight, or sneaking into bed with the other group's wives and daughters. I watched it. Season after season. Sometimes I watched from the high cliff wall, where I could look out and see all the mead hall lights on the various hills across the countryside, glowing like candles, reflected stars. With luck, I might see, on a soft summer night, as many as 3 halls burning down at once. That was rare, of course. It grew rarer as the pattern of their warring changed. Hrothgar, who'd begun hardly stronger than the others, began to outstrip the rest. He'd worked out a theory about what fighting was for, and now he no longer fought with his 6 closest neighbors. He'd shown them the strength of his organization, and now, instead of making war on them, he sent men to them every 3 months or so with heavy wagons and backslings to gather their tribute to his greatness. They piled his wagons high with gold and leather and weapons, and they kneeled to his messengers and made long speeches and promised to defend him against any foolhardy outlaw that dared to attack him. Hrothgar's messengers answered with friendly words and praise of the man they'd just plundered, as if the whole thing had been his idea, then whipped up the oxen, pulled up their loaded backslings, and started home. It was a hard trip. The tall, silky grass of the meadows and the paths along the forest would clog the heavy wagon spokes and snarl the oxen's hooves. wagon wheels sunk in the rich black earth that only the wind had ever yet seeded or harvested. The oxen rolled their eyes, floundering and mooed. Men swore. They pushed at the wheels with long oak poles and slashed at the oxen till their backs were cross-hatched with bleeding welts and their noses ran pink foam. Sometimes, with one terrific heave, an ox would break free of the traces and plunge into the brush. A man on a horse would go after it, slashed by branches, cutting through tangles of hazel and hawthorn, his horse balking at the pain of thorns, and sometimes, when the man found the ox, he would fill it with arrows and leave it to the wolves. Sometimes he merely sat when he found the ox, and met its stupid, gloomy eyes, and wept. Sometimes a horse, mired to the waist, would give up and merely stand, head hanging as if waiting for death. And the men would howl at it and cut it with whips, or throw stones or club it with heavy limbs, until finally one of them came to his senses and calmed the others, and they would winch out the horse with ropes and wagon wheels if they could, or else abandon the horse or kill it, first stripping off the saddle and bridle and the handsomely decorated harness. At times, when a wagon was hopelessly mired, the men would walk back to Hrothgar's hall for help. When they returned, the wagon would be emptied of all its gold and burned, sometimes by people of Hrothgar's own tribe, though usually by others, and the oxen and horses would be dead. Hrothgar met with his council for many nights and days. And they drank and talked and prayed to their curious carved-out creatures, and finally came to a decision. They built roads. The kings from whom they'd taken tributes of treasure, they now asked for tributes of men. Then Hrothgar and his neighbors, loaded like ants on a long march, pushed foot by foot and day by day around the marshes and over the moors and through the woods, pressing flat rocks into the soft ground and grass, and packing smaller stones around the rocks' sides, until, from my watch on the wall of the cliff, Hrothgar's whole realm was like a wobbly, lopsided wheel with spokes of stone. And now, when enemies from farther out struck at kings who called themselves Hrothgar's friends, a messenger would slip out and ride through the night to the tribute-taker, and in half an hour, while the enemy bands were still shouting at each other, still waving their ash spears and saying what horrible things they would do, the forest would rumble with the sound of Hrothgar's horsemen. He would overcome them. His band had grown large. And for the treasures Hrothgar could afford now to give them in sign of his thanks, his warriors became hornets. New roads snaked out. New mead halls gave tribute. His treasure hoard grew till his mead hall was piled to the rafters with brightly painted shields and ornamented swords and boar's head helmets and coils of gold. And they had to abandon the mead hall and sleep in the outbuildings. Meanwhile, those who paid tribute to him were forced to strike at more distant halls to gather the gold they paid to Hrothgar, and a little on the side for themselves. His power overran the world, from the foot of my cliff to the northern sea to the impenetrable forests south and east. They hacked down trees in widening rings around their central halls, and blistered the land with peasant huts and pig-pen fences till the forest looked like an old dog dying of mange. They thinned out the game, killed birds for sport, set accidental fires that would burn for days. Their sheep killed hedges, snipped valleys bare, and their pigs nosed up the very roots of what might have grown. Hrothgar's tribe made boats to drive farther north and west. There was nothing to stop the advance of man. Huge boars fled at the click of a harness. Wolves would cower in the glens like foxes when they caught that deadly scent. I was filled with a wordless, obscurely murderous unrest. One night, inevitably, a blind man turned up at Hrothgar's temporary mead hall. He was carrying a harp. I watched from the shadow of a cowshed, since on that hill there were no trees. The guards at the door crossed their axes in front of him. He waited, smiling foolishly, while a messenger went inside. A few minutes later, the messenger returned, gave the old man a grunt, and, cautiously, feeling ahead of himself with his crooked bare toes like a man engaged in some strange pious dance, the foolish smile still fixed on his face, the blind old man went in. A boy darted up from the weeds at the foot of the hill, the harper's companion. He, too, was shown in. The hall became quiet. And after a moment, Hrothgar spoke. Tones low and measured, of necessity, from too much shouting on midnight raids. The harper gave him back some answer, and Hrothgar spoke again. I glanced at the watchdogs. They still sat silent as tree stumps, locked in my spell. I crept closer to the hall to hear. The people were noisy for a time, yelling to the harper, offering him mead, making jokes, and then again King Hrothgar spoke, white-bearded. The hall became still. The silence expanded. People coughed. As if all by itself, then the harp made a curious run of sounds, almost words. And then a moment later, arresting as a voice from a hollow tree, the harper began to chant. Lo, we have heard the honor of the Spear-Danes, nation kings in days now gone, how those battle-lords brought themselves glory. Oft Shield-Sheffing shattered the forces of kinsmen marauders, dragged away their mead-hall benches, terrified earls, after first men found him castaway. He got recompense for that. He grew up under the clouds, won glory of men till all his enemies, sitting around him, heard across the whale roads his demands and gave him tribute. That was a good king. So he sang, or intoned, with the harp behind him, twisting together like sailors' ropes the bits and pieces of the best old songs. The people were hushed. Even the surrounding hills were hushed, as if brought low by language. He knew his art. He was king of the shapers, harp-string scratchers, oak-moss-bearded, inspired by winds. That was what had brought him over wilderness, down blind man's alleys of time and space, to Hrothgar's famous hall. He would sing the glory of Hrothgar's line, and gild his wisdom, and stir up his men to more daring deeds, for a price. He told how Scyld, by the cunning of arms, had rebuilt the old Danish kingdom from ashes, lordless a long time before he came, and the prey of every passing band, and how Scyld's son, by the strength of his wits, had increased their power, a man who fully understood men's need, from lust to love, and knew how to use it to fashion a mile-wide fist of chain-locked steel. He sang of battles and marriages, of funerals and hangings, the whimperings of beaten enemies, of splendid hunts and harvests. He sang of Hrothgar, hoar-frost white, magnificent of mind. When he finished, the hall was as quiet as a mound. I, too, was silent, my ear pressed tight against the timbers. Even to me, incredibly, he had made it all seem true and very fine. Now a little, now more, a great roar began, an exhalation of breath that swelled to a rumble of voices, and then to the howling and clapping and stomping of men gone mad on art. They would seize the oceans, the farthest stars, the deepest secret rivers in Hrothgar's name. Men wept like children. Children sat stunned. It went on and on, a fire more dread than any visible fire. Only one man in the kingdom seemed cast down. The man who'd been Hrothgar's harper before the blind man came to make his bid. The former harper crept out into the darkness, unnoticed by the rest. He slipped away through fields and forests, his precious old instrument under his arm, to seek out refuge in the hall of some lesser marauder. I too crept away, my mind aswim in ringing phrases, magnificent, golden, and all of them, incredibly, lies. What was he? The man had changed the world, had torn up the past by its thick, gnarled roots, and had transmuted it. And they, who knew the truth, remembered it his way. And so did I. I crossed the moors in a queer panic, like a creature half insane. I knew the truth. It was late spring. Every sheep and goat had its wobbly twins. A man said, "I'll steal their gold and burn their mead hall," and another man said, "Do it now." I remembered the ragged men fighting each other till the snow was red slush, whining in winter, the shriek of people and animals burning, the whip-slashed oxen in the mire, the scattered battle leavings, wolf-torn corpses, falcons fat with blood. Yet I also remembered, as if it had happened, Great Shield, of whose kingdom no trace remained, and his far-sighted son, of whose greater kingdom no trace remained. And the stars overhead were alive with the promise of Hrothgar's vast power, his universal peace. The moors, their axes had stripped of trees, glowed silver in the moonlight, and the yellow lights of peasant huts were like scattered jewels on the raven-dark cloak of a king. I was so filled with sorrow and tenderness, I could hardly have found it in my heart to snatch a pig. Thus I fled, ridiculous, hairy creature torn apart by poetry, crawling, whimpering, streaming tears across the world like a two-headed beast, like mixed-up lamb and kid at the tail of a baffled, indifferent ewe. And I gnashed my teeth and clutched the sides of my head as if to heal the split. But I couldn't. There was a Shield once who ruled the Danes, and other men ruled after him. That much was true. And the rest? At the top of the cliff wall I turned and looked down. And I saw all the lights of Hrothgar's realm, and the realms beyond that that would soon be his. And to clear my mind I sucked in wind and screamed. The sound went out, violent, to the rims of the world. And after a moment it bounced back up at me, harsh and ungodly against the sigh of the remembered harp. Like a thousand tortured rat squeals crying, "Lost!" I clamped my palms to my ears, and stretched up my lips, and shrieked again. A stab at truth, a snatch at apocalyptic glee. Then I ran on all fours, chest pounding, to the smoky mere. Chapter 4. He sings to a heavier harp song now, old heart-string scratcher, memory scraper. of the richest of kings made sick of soul by the scattered bones of thanes. By late afternoon the fire dies down, and the column of smoke is white, no longer greasy. There will be others this year, they know, yet they hang on. The sun backs away from the world like a crab, and the days grow shorter, the nights grow longer, more dark and dangerous. I smile, angry in the thickening dusk, and feast my eyes on the greatest of mead halls, unsatisfied. His pride, the torch of kingdoms, heart. The shaper remains, though now there are nobler courts where he might sing, the pride of creation. He built this hall by the power of his songs, created with casual words its grave morality, mortality. The boy observes him, tall and solemn, 12 years older than the night he first crept in with his stone-eyed master. He knows no art but tragedy, a moving singer. The credit is wholly mine. Inspired by winds, or whatever you please, the old man sang of a glorious mead hall whose light would shine to the ends of the ragged world. The thought took seed in Hrothgar's mind. It grew. He called all his people together and told them his daring scheme. He would build a magnificent mead hall high on a hill with a view of the western sea, a victory seat near the giant's work, old ruined fortress from the world's first war, to stand forever as a sign of the glory and justice of Hrothgar's Danes. There he would sit and give treasures out, all wealth but the lives of men, and the people's land. And so his sons would do after him, and his sons' sons to the final generation. I listened, huddled in the darkness, tormented, mistrustful. I knew them, had watched them, yet the things he said seemed true. He sent to far kingdoms for woodsmen, carpenters, metalsmiths, goldsmiths, also carters, victuallers, clothiers to attend to the workmen, and for weeks their uproar filled the days and nights. I watched from the vines and boulders of the giant's ruin, 2 miles off. Then word went out to the races of men that Hrothgar's hall was finished. He gave it its name. From neighboring realms and from across the sea came men to the great celebration. The harper sang. I listened, felt myself swept up. I knew very well that all he said was ridiculous. Not light for their darkness, but flattery, illusion. A vortex pulling them from sunlight to heat, a kind of midsummer burgeoning waltz to the sickle. Yet I was swept up. Ridiculous, I hissed in the black of the forest. I snatched up a snake from beside my foot and whispered to it, I knew him when. But I couldn't bring out a wicked cackle as I'd meant to do. My heart was light with Hrothgar's goodness, and leaden with grief at my own bloodthirsty ways. I backed away, crab-like, further into darkness, like a crab retreating in pain when you strike 2 stones at the mouth of his underwater den. I backed away till the honey-sweet lure of the harp no longer mocked me. Yet even now my mind was tormented by images. Thanes filled the hall, and a great silent crowd of them spilled out over the surrounding hill, smiling, peaceable, hearing the harper as if not a man in all that lot had ever twisted a knife in his neighbor's chest. "Well, then, he's changed them," I said, and stumbled and fell on the root of a tree. "Why not?" "Why not?" the forest whispered back. Yet not the forest, something deeper, an impression from another mind, some live thing, old and terrible. I listened, tensed. Not a sound. "He reshapes the world," I whispered, belligerent. "So his name implies. He stares, strange-eyed, at the mindless world and turns dry sticks to gold." A little poetic, I would readily admit. His manner of speaking was infecting me, making me pompous. "Nevertheless," I whispered crossly, but I couldn't go on, too conscious all at once of my whispering, my eternal posturing, always transforming the world with words, changing nothing. I still had the snake in my fist. I set it down. It fled. "He takes what he finds," I said stubbornly, trying again. "And by changing men's minds, he makes the best of it. Why not?" But it sounded petulant. And it wasn't true, I knew. He sang for pay, for the praise of women, one in particular, and for the honor of a famous king's hand on his arm. If the ideas of art were beautiful, that was art's fault, not the shaper's. A blind selector, almost mindless, a bird. Did they murder each other more gently because in the woods sweet songbirds sang? Yet I wasn't satisfied. His fingers picked infallibly, as if moved by something beyond his power. And the words stitched together out of ancient songs, the scenes interwoven out of dreary tales, made a vision without seams, an image of himself yet not himself, beyond the need of any shaggy old gold friend's pay. The projected possible. "Why not?" I whispered, jerking forward, struggling to make my ears sear through the dark trunks and vines. I could feel it all around me, that invisible presence, chilly as the first intimation of death, the dusty, unblinking eyes of a thousand snakes. There was no sound. I touched a fat, slick loop of vine, prepared to leap back in horror, but it was only vine. No worse. And still no sound. No movement. I got up on my feet, bent over, squinting, and edged back through the trees toward the town. It followed me, whatever it was. I was as sure of that as I'd ever been of anything. And then, in one instant, as if it had all been my mind, the thing was gone. In the hall, they were laughing. Men and women stood talking in the light of the mead hall door and on the narrow streets below. On the lower hillside, boys and girls played near the sheep pens, shyly holding hands. A few lay touching each other in the forest eaves. I thought how they'd shriek if I suddenly showed my face, and it made me smile. But I held myself back. They talked nothing. Stupidities. Their soft voices groping like hands. I felt myself tightening, cross, growing restless for no clear reason. And I made myself move more slowly. Then, circling the clearing, I stepped on something fleshy and jerked away. It was a man. They'd cut his throat. His clothes had been stolen. I stared up at the hall, baffled, beginning to shake. They went on talking softly, touching hands, their hair full of light. I lifted up the body and slung it across my shoulder. Then the harp began to play. The crowd grew still. The harp sighed. The old man sang, as sweet-voiced as a child. He told how the earth was first built long ago, said that the greatest of gods made the world, every wonder-bright plain and the turning seas, and set out as signs of his victory the sun and moon, great lamps for light to land-dwellers, kingdom torches, and adorned the fields with all colors and shapes, made limbs and leaves, and gave life to the every creature that moves on land. The harp turned solemn. He told of an ancient feud between two brothers, which split all the world between darkness and light. And I, Grendel, was the dark side, he said in effect, the terrible race God cursed. I believed him. Such was the power of the Shaper's harp. Stood wriggling my face, letting tears down my nose, grinding my fists into my streaming eyes, even though to do it I had to squeeze with my elbow the corpse of the proof that both of us were cursed, or neither, that the brothers had never lived, nor the god who judged them. Wah! I bawled. Oh, what a conversion! I staggered out into the open and up toward the hall with my burden, groaning out, "Mercy! Peace!" The harper broke off. The people screamed. They have their own versions, but this is the truth. Drunken men rushed me with battle axes. I sank to my knees, crying, "Friend! Friend!" They hacked at me, yipping like dogs. I held up the body for protection. Their spears came through it, and one of them nicked me, a tiny scratch high on my left breast, but I knew by the sting it had venom on it, and I understood, as shocked as I'd been the first time, that they could kill me. Eventually would, if I gave them a chance. I struck at them, holding the body as a shield, and two fell bleeding from my nails at the first little swipe. The others backed off. I crushed the body in my hug, then hurled it in their faces, turned, and fled. They didn't follow. I ran to the center of the forest and fell down panting. My mind was wild. Pity, I moaned. Oh, pity, pity, I wept. Strong monster with teeth like a shark's. And I slammed the earth with such force that a seam split open 12 feet long. "Bastards!" I roared. "Sons of bitches! Fuckers!" Words I'd picked up from men in their rages. I wasn't even sure what they meant, though I had an idea. Defiance, rejection of the gods that, for my part, I'd known all along to be lifeless sticks. I roared with laughter, still sobbing. We, the accursed, didn't even have words for swearing in. "Ugh!" I whooped, then covered my ears and hushed. It sounded silly. My sudden awareness of my foolishness made me calm. I looked up through the treetops, ludicrously hopeful. I think I was half prepared in my dark, demented state to see God, bearded and gray as geometry, scowling down at me, shaking his bloodless finger. "Why can't I have someone to talk to?" I said. The stars said nothing, but I pretended to ignore the rudeness. "The Shaper has people to talk to," I said. I wrung my fingers. "Hrothgar has people to talk to." I thought about it. Perhaps it wasn't true. As a matter of fact, If the Shaper's vision of goodness and peace was a part of himself, not idle rhymes, then no one understood him at all, not even Hrothgar. And as for Hrothgar, if he was serious about his idea of glory, sons and sons' sons giving out treasure, I had news for him. If he had sons, they wouldn't hear his words. They would weigh his silver and gold in their minds. I've watched the generations. I've seen their weasel eyes. I fought down my smile. "That could change," I said, shaking my finger as if at an audience. "The Shaper may yet improve men's minds, bring peace to the miserable Danes." But they were doomed, I knew, and I was glad, no denying it. Let them wander the fog roads of hell. 2 nights later, I went back. I was addicted. The Shaper was singing the glorious deeds of the dead men, praising war. He sang how they'd fought me. It was all lies. The sly harp rasped like snakes in cattails, glorifying death. I snatched a guard and smashed him on a tree, but my stomach turned at the thought of eating him. "Woe to the man," the Shaper sang, "who shall through wicked hostilities shove his soul down into the fire's hug. Let him hope for no change, he can never turn away. But lucky the man who, after his death day, shall seek the prince, find peace in his father's embrace." "Bullshit," I whispered through clenched teeth. How was it that he could enrage me so? Why not? The darkness hissed around me. Why not? Why not? Teasing, tormenting, as cold as a dead hand closing on my wrist. Imagination, I knew. Some evil inside myself pushed out into the trees. I knew what I knew. The mindless, mechanical bruteness of things. And when the harper's lure drew my mind away to hopeful dreams, the dark of what was and always was reached out and snatched my feet. And yet I'd be surprised, I had to admit, if anything in myself could be as cold, as dark, as centuries old, as the presence I felt around me. I touched a vine to reassure myself. It was a snake. I snapped back in terror. Then I calmed myself again. The fangs hadn't hit. It came to me that the presence was still there, somewhere deeper, much deeper, in the night. I had a feeling that if I let myself, I could fall toward it, that it was pulling me, pulling the whole world in, like a whirlpool. Craziness, of course. I got up, though the feeling was as strong as ever, and felt my way back through the forest and over to the cliff wall, and back to the mere and to my cave. I lay there listening to the indistinct memory of the Shaper's songs. My mother picked through the bone pile, sullen. I'd brought no food. "Ridiculous," I whispered. She looked at me. It was a cold-blooded lie that a god had lovingly made the world and set out the sun and moon as lights to land-dwellers, that brothers had fought, that one of the races was saved, the other cursed. Yet he, the old Shaper, might make it true by the sweetness of his harp, his cunning trickery. It came to me with a fierce jolt that I wanted it. As they did, too, though vicious animals, cunning, cracked with theories. I wanted it, yes. Even if I must be the outcast, cursed by the rules of his hideous fable. She whimpered, scratched at the nipple I had not sucked in years. She was pitiful, foul, her smile a jagged white tear in the firelight. Waste. She whimpered one sound, dool-dool, dool-dool, scratching at her bosom, a ghastly attempt to climb back up to speech. I clamped my eyes shut, listened to the river, and after a time, I slept. I sat up with a jerk. The thing was all around me now, like a thunder charge. "Who is it?" I said. No answer. Darkness. My mother was asleep. She was as dead-looking as a red-gray old sea-elephant stretched on the shore of a summer day. I got up and silently left the cave. I went to the cliff wall, then down to the moor. Still nothing. I made my mind a blank, and fell, sank away like a stone through earth and sea, toward the dragon. Chapter 5. No use of a growl, a whoop, a roar in the presence of that beast. Vast, red-golden, huge tail coiled, limbs sprawled over his treasure hoard, eyes not fiery but cold as the memory of family deaths. Vanishing away across invisible floors, there were things of gold, gems, jewels, silver vessels the color of blood in the undulant dragon-red light. Arching above him, the ceiling and upper walls of his cave were alive with bats. The color of his sharp scales darkened and brightened as the dragon inhaled and exhaled slowly, drawing new air across his vast internal furnace. His razor-sharp tusks gleamed and glinted as if they too, like the mountain beneath him, were formed of precious stones and metals. My heart shook. His eyes stared straight at me. My knees and insides were so weak I had to drop down on all fours. His mouth opened slightly. Bits of flame escaped. "Ah, Grendel," he said, "you've come." The voice was startling, no rolling boom as I would have expected, but a voice that might have come from an old, old man. Louder, of course, but not much louder. "We've been expecting you," he said. He gave a nervous laugh, like a miser caught at his counting. His eyes were heavy-lidded, minutely veined, wrinkled like an elderly mead-drinker's. "Stand around the side, if you don't mind, boy," he said. "I get a cough sometimes, and it's terrible straight out front." The high, dead eyelids wrinkled more. The corners of his mouth snaked up as he chuckled, sly, hardly hiding his malice. I quickly ducked around to the side. "Good boy," he said. He tipped his head, lowering an eye toward me. "Smart boy, he, he, he." He lifted a wrinkled paw with man-length talons for nails and held it over my head as if to crush me with it. But he merely brought it down lightly, once, twice, three times, patting my head.
"Well, speak, boy," he said. "Say hello there, Mr. Dragon."
He cackled. My throat convulsed, and I tried to get my breath to speak, but I couldn't. The dragon smiled. Horrible, debauched, mouth limp and cracked, loose against the teeth as an ancient dog's.
Now you know how they feel when they see you, eh? Scared enough to pee in their pants.
He looked startled by an unpleasant thought, then cross.
You didn't, did you?
I shook my head.
Good, he said. That's valuable stuff you're standing on. Boobies, hemorrhoids, boils, slaver. Now!
He moved his head as if adjusting his flaking neck to a tight metal collar, and put on what looked like, for him, a sober expression, like an old drunk preparing a solemn face for court. Then, as if involuntarily, he cackled again. It was horrible. Horrible. Obscene. He couldn't stop himself. He cackled so hard, a brilliant tear like a giant diamond rolled down his cheek. And still he couldn't stop. He raised up the taloned paw and pointed at me. His head tipped back, laughing, blowing fire out his mouth and nostrils. He tried to say something, but the laughing got worse. He rolled over on his side, stretching up one vast, wrinkled wing for balance, covering his eyes with one claw, still pointing with the other, roaring with laughter, and kicking a little with his two back feet. I felt cross all at once, though I didn't dare show it.
"Like a rabbit," he brought out. "Nye-hee-hee. When you're scared, you look nye-hee-hee. Exactly. Exactly."
I scowled, and realizing I had my hands out in front of me, like a rabbit sitting up, I jerked them behind my back. My scowl of rage nearly finished him. He hooted, gasped, sobbed, began to choke with laughter. I forgot myself completely. I snatched up an emerald the size of a fist and pulled it back to throw it at him. He was sober instantly.
"Put it down," he said.
He drew in breath and turned his huge head straight at me. I dropped it and fought to keep my bowels from moving down.
"Don't touch," he said.
The old man's voice was as terrible now as the eyes. It was as if he'd been dead for a thousand years.
"Never, never, never touch my things," he said.
Flame came out with the words and singed the hair on my belly and legs. I nodded, trembling all over.
"Good," he said.
He stared at me a moment longer, then slowly turned his head away. Then, old womanish, as if he were, though still spiteful, slightly embarrassed, he got back up onto his treasure pile, stretched out his wings, and settled. He was in the foulest of moods. I doubted that I could learn anything from him now. I'd be lucky to get away alive. I thought all at once about what he'd said. "Now you know how they feel when they see you." He had a point. From now on I'd stay clear of them. It was one thing to eat one from time to time. That was only natural. Kept them from overpopulating, maybe starving to death come winter. But it was another thing to scare them, give them heart attacks, fill their nights with nightmares just for sport.
"Fiddlesticks,"
the dragon said. I blinked.
"Fiddlesticks, that's what I said," he repeated. "Why not frighten them? Creature, I could tell you things."
He rolled his eyes up under the heavy lids and made a noise.
"Glar!"
He remained that way, breathing hard with peevish anger.
"Stupid! Stupid! Stupid!"
he hissed.
"The whole damned kit and caboodle! Why did you come here? Why do you bother me? Don't answer," he added quickly, stopping me. "I know what's in your mind. I know everything. That's what makes me so sick and old and tired.
I'm sorry, I said.
Be still,
he screamed. Flame shot clear to the cave mouth.
I know you're sorry, for right now, that is, for this one frail, foolish flicker-flash in the long, dull fall of eternity. I'm unimpressed. No, be still!
His eye burst open like a hole to hush me. I closed my mouth. The eye was terrible, lowering toward me. I felt as if I were tumbling down into it, dropping endlessly down through a soundless void. He let me fall, down and down toward a black sun and spiders, though he knew I was beginning to die. Nothing could have been more disinterested. Serpent to the core. But then he spoke after all, or rather laughed, and reality snapped back. Laughed, spoke, and broke my fall, not as a kindness to me, but because of his cold pleasure in knowing what he knew. I was in the cave again, and his horrible smile was snaking up his wrinkled cheek, and his eye was once more half closed.
"You want the word," he said. "That's what you've come for. My advice is, don't ask. Do as I do. Seek out gold, but not my gold, and guard it."
"Why?" I said.
"Be still!"
The cave went white with his fire, and the rock walls roared the echo back. Bats flew like dust in a granary, then returned to their places, a few at a time, until all was still again, motionless, as if lifeless. His wings, which had stretched out slightly, relaxed and settled. I waited for what seemed hours, huddling, my fingers protecting my head. Then,
"You want to know about the Shaper?"
I nodded.
"Illusion," he said.
He half smiled, then let it go as if infinitely weary, sick of time.
"I know everything, you see,"
the old voice wheedled.
"The beginning, the present, the end. Everything. You now, you see the past and the present, like other low creatures. No higher faculties than memory and perception. But dragons, my boy, have a whole different kind of mind."
He stretched his mouth in a kind of smile, no trace of pleasure in it.
"We see from the mountain top all time, all space. We see in one instant the passionate vision and the blowout. Not that we cause things to fail, you understand?"
He was testy all at once, as if answering an argument that had been put to him so often he was sick of it.
"Dragons don't mess with your piddling free will, pa." "Listen to me, boy."
The dead eye brightened.
"If you, with your knowledge of present and past, recall that a certain man slipped on, say, a banana peel, or fell off his chair, or drowned in a river, that recollection does not mean that you caused him to slip, or fall, or drown. Correct? Of course it's correct. It happened, and you know it. But knowledge is not cause. Of course, anyone who argues otherwise is a stupid ignoramus. Well, so with me. My knowledge of the future does not cause the future, it merely sees it, exactly as creatures at your low level recall things past. And even if, say, I interfere, burn up somebody's mead hall, for instance, whether because I just feel like it or because some supplicant asked me to, even then I do not change the future. I merely do what I saw from the beginning. That's obvious, surely. Let's say it's settled, then. So much for free will and intercession. The dragon's eye closed to a slit. Grendel! I jumped. Don't look so bored, he said. He scowled, black as midnight. Think how I must feel, he said. I almost said, I'm sorry, but caught myself. Man, he said, then left a long pause, letting scorn build up in the cave like the venom in his breath. I can see you understand them. Counters, measurers, theory makers. All pigs eat cheese. Old Snaggle is a pig. If Snaggle is sick and refuses to eat, try cheese. Games, 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 he snorted fire. They only think they think. No total vision, total system. Merely schemes with a vague family resemblance. No more identity than bridges and, say, spiderwebs. But they rush across chasms on spiderwebs, and sometimes they make it, and that, they think, settles that. I could tell you 1,000 tiresome stories of their absurdity. They'd map out roads through hell with their crackpot theories, their here-to-the-moon-and-back lists of paltry facts. Insanity. The simplest insanity ever devised. Simple facts in isolation, and facts to connect them, ands and buts, are the sine qua non of all their glorious achievement. But there are no such facts. Connectedness is the essence of everything. It doesn't stop them, of course. They build the whole world out of teeth, deprived of bodies to chew or be chewed on. They sense that, of course, from time to time. Have uneasy feelings that all they live by is nonsense. They have dim apprehensions that such propositions as God does not exist are somewhat dubious, at least in comparison with statements like all carnivorous cows eat meat. That's where the Shaper saves them, provides an illusion of reality, puts together all their facts with a gluey wine of connectedness. Mere tripe, believe me. Mere sleight of wits. He knows no more than they do about total reality, less, if anything. Works with the same old clutter of atoms, the givens of his time and place and tongue. But he spins it all together with harp runs and hoots, and they think what they think is alive, think heaven loves them. It keeps them going, for what that's worth. As for myself, I can hardly bear to look. I see, I said. It was to some extent untrue. The dragon smiled, seemed almost friendly for an instant. You've been very attentive and thoughtful, he said. All things considered. So I will tell you about time and space. Thank you, I said, as heartily as I could manage. I had more than enough to think about, it seemed to me.
He scowled, and I said no more. He took a deep breath, shifted his forelegs to a position more comfortable, and after a moment's thought, began. In all discussions of nature, we must try to remember the differences of scale.